ആവശ്യ കൃഷ്ണ പ്രസാദ ഭൂതലക്ഷ്മി ഭക്തദാന സ്വാമി നമനെ നമസ്തേ സരസ്വതി ദേവി ശ്രീകൃഷ്ണ ചൈതന്യ പ്രഭുവിനം ശ്രീകൃഷ്ണവൃന്ദ ഹരേ കൃഷ്ണ ഹരേ കൃഷ്ണ 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 ഹരേ ഹരേ രാമ ഹരേ രാമ 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 ഹരേ ഹരേ. സോ we are going to try to cover contents of Hariram Chintamani, which is a work by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is the father of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who is the spiritual master of Srila Prabhupada. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a very prolific writer. He wrote many wonderful works, which are easy to understand, and in a very creative way he's presented the philosophy and teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to the public. Most of his books are in Bengali, some are in Sanskrit, and in Bengali some are in prose and some are in poetry. This particular work is actually in verse, a poetry, but its subject matter is basically philosophical in nature. But still, it is expressed very simply so that people can understand very easily. And the content, of course, is simply a discussion of the chanting of the holy name, the significance, types of holy name, types of chanting, and ultimately a discussion of the namaparads. There are 10 namaparads, and he goes into each one, spends a chapter on each one. And at the end of the book, then he discusses seva aparads and other things. Basically about the holy name and nama aparads. So because our main process is chanting the holy name, taking shelter of the holy name for our advancement, it is important that we understand all the teachings about the holy name and also about the nama aparads. Every morning we recite the nama aparads. We're supposed to avoid them, but we should also know what they mean. So this book actually tells us the exact meaning of those aparads, how to avoid them, and how to remedy the situation if we commit them. So it's quite important for us to know. So, first few chapters, there's a general introduction about the placement of the holy name, the nature of the holy name, and then after that, what is called Namabhas, and then after that, all the rest of the chapters are about basically namaparada. So since we only got 4 classes, I'll try to cover at least 3 or 4 chapters right now. Now, if you don't understand a particular thing, you're not clear on what it means, or if I use some terminology, probably Sanskrit, and you don't know what they mean, then you can please ask, because I'm assuming you know something, but maybe you don't know something. So if you don't know what something means, then you please ask, and then I can clarify. So the first chapter is an introduction, and in this introduction, Bhaktivinoda Thakur just makes a setting for his book, and then begins by explaining the holy name in relation to everything else in our theology. So this is basically a book, or a recitation by Haridas Thakur. Of course, we do not have Haridas Thakur's words in detail anywhere, but we do have some narrations of his activities and teachings in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So from those few incidents, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has enlarged what he said there, and presented through his mouth the glorification of the holy name and the teachings of the holy name. So most of the book is actually through the mouth of Haridas Thakur, who is the Namacharya. So the first part is actually simply locates the holy name within our whole process. So what is the holy name? The holy name obviously is the name of the Supreme Lord, the name of Krishna. But then who is Krishna? So then in this first chapter he actually discusses what we call Sambandha Gyan. Sambandha means a relationship, Gyan means knowledge, so technically Sambandha Gyan means knowledge of a relationship. But this is a term which is used by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu very, very significantly. We'll see this mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He says actually the Vedic literature has only discussed three basic topics, though it looks like the contents of the Vedas and Puranas is very vast. Ultimately, only three subject matters ultimately arise. One is Sambandha Gyan, another is called Abhijaya, and the third is called Prayojana. So in simple terms, that means a philosophy, that is Sambandha Gyan, that is a definition of who and what, and the relationships, that's Sambandha Gyan. Abhijaya means action, ultimately the process of what type of activity we do in this material world as sadhana. And Prayojana means what is the ultimate goal of that sadhana. So the Sambandha Gyan is the basis for doing activity. Then we have the activity itself, sadhana, bhakti, and then we have the goal of sadhana, bhakti. If we, of course, think about it, we'll find that everything we do is based on such things. In other words, we get some knowledge, based on the knowledge we do an activity, and the activity leads to some goal. So therefore, in our activity of devotional service, we have our things for set up. And these are the basic things which are covered in the Vedic literatures, these three things. A philosophy, activity, and the goal. So, what is the philosophy? This, of course, becomes a big subject matter among different religious schools, basically the Mayavadis and the Vaishnavas. What is that? Sambandha Gyan. So, in our philosophy, we have Ishvara, or Supreme Lord, or God, which is common to all theologies. They have a belief in a supreme God. What does that mean? Ishvara means, of course, one who controls, literally. But to be more specific, when we say Ishvara, we mean a conscious entity or person, one who has got capacity for knowledge and has free will, but who is also independent of everything else. He does not depend on any other object or any other person or any other entity for his existence in any way. In other words, he doesn't depend on another entity for his cause. In other words, no one creates God. And he is not dependent on any other living entity for maintaining his existence. And he cannot be destroyed by any other entity or any other thing. And his will, his free will, is independent of everything else. He can make a decision and carry it out. And he is not dependent on his free will on some other person or thing. So he is a supreme, independent, conscious, living entity. That is the definition of God. Or Ishvara. But in our philosophy we have not only Ishvara, we have other entities. In the Mayavad philosophy, they also believe in a Ishvara of sorts, they call Brahman. But he's also a supreme conscious entity. Same entity with no cause also. But the difference between Mayavad philosophy and our philosophy is that in our philosophy, the Supreme Lord does have expansions, which we call energies. There's the Lord, but there are other things, there are other objects also besides the Lord, which are real. In the Mayavad philosophy, only this one object, the Lord, exists. Everything else which seems to exist does not really exist. It is Maya. That's what we call Maya philosophy. Other than the Lord, nothing exists. It's all Maya. So, in other words, the jivas do not exist, nor does material energy exist. Nor do qualities of the Lord Himself exist for the Maya body. In our philosophy, there's a Supreme Lord, but He does have expansions of energy. And through these expansions of energy belonging to the Lord has form, name, qualities, and activities. In other words, the Lord has a personality and everything that goes with that. So this is due to His energies. Not only the Lord has His own personality and name, etc., but He also has a world we call a Dham, which is real also. And that Dham, of course, is made out of His spiritual energy, Shiv Shakti. And not only that, there are also other living entities there. So we get jivas also existing. Jivas are living entities, conscious entities, like the Supreme Lord. They are different from the Supreme Lord because they are called amsa. They are called parts. And the Lord is considered the whole. Nevertheless, they are Satchitananda, they have the same qualities as the Lord, more or less. So the Lord has an energy called the Chit Shakti or Antaranga Shakti. He has another Shakti called the Jeev Shakti, which produces the living entities. And then He has another energy called the Achit Shakti, or material energy, which produces the material world, as we know it here. And all these energies are real. They're not imaginary, they're not illusory or anything. They're real. They factually exist. So therefore, the Lord exists with His personality, factually. He has a spiritual world, or a Dhamma, which is factual. It really exists. There are other personalities called jivas who have their own independent free will and consciousness. And they are also real, not illusory. And there's the material world that exists with 14 parts in it. That is also real. It's not illusory. So this is basically what Sambandhagyan means. A Supreme Lord with a material energy, jivas, and a spiritual world. And if we have that, then we can have bhakti. If we don't have jivas, there's no question of bhakti. If the jivas are not real, there is no bhakti, no concept of bhakti. And if the Lord doesn't have any energies, then there is no personality for the Lord either. He has no name, qualities, form, activities at all, if He has no energies. If there's only the Supreme Lord finished, then He becomes formless. So the idea of the Lord and His energies is quite important. If the Lord does not have real energies, then we don't have a personality for the Lord, Supreme Personality of God. It won't exist, nor will any devotional service to the Lord exist. So this is this concept we call Sambandhagyan, defining the different things which exist. So the Lord exists, the jivas exist, material world exists, and spiritual world exists. These are the things which exist. Now the only problem comes when the jivas are in the material world. If we only have a spiritual world with jivas there and we have a Supreme Lord, there is no problems at all. And we don't even need a philosophy. But we have a material world and then we have jivas in the material world, and this is where we begin to get some problems, because the jiva in the material world ultimately can never be satisfied in this position. It's always it's like the fish out of water. Now a fish is natural when he's in the water and he can live very nicely. When we take the fish out of water and put him on land, even if we give him all sorts of nice things, we give him a nice room, give him a bed, give him a television set, give him a car, and give him nice food, he won't be very happy. He won't last very long. So, in the same way, the jiva in the material world, we can supply the jiva with all sorts of nice things, a nice material body, nice sense gratification, but actually cannot be happy. Why? Because the jiva is like the Lord, he's spiritual. He's chit, and the material world is achit. So basically, incompatible. It's like the fish out of water. So, the jiva can never be happy in the material world because all of his experiences are in terms of achit things. His relationships are all based on achit or matter. And he is basically chit. So, whatever type of so called happiness he gets actually is the sukha is achit. It's part of the achit world. And he is chit. So, it's not no compatibility. The only way we can think we're happy is through illusion. So that is where the illusion is. Not that the material world is unreal or the jiva is unreal, but the happiness is unreal. That is the illusion. So, this of course is beneficial for the jiva, because sooner or later, jiva will begin to, if he's intelligent, he will begin to realize, I am not happy in this material world. And when he does that, then he begins to question, as a human being he can question, and then he can begin to get association and practice spiritual life. And then we give this someone again to him. And based on that, then he begins to do the activity of bhakti, and based on that, he can achieve the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world, the prayojana of the goal. The philosophy is very important, because if we don't know exactly who we are, and we don't know exactly who the Lord is, it is impossible to work towards that goal. This will be discussed a little later under Nama Bhas. But we have to have a clear idea of the nature of the Supreme Lord and our nature in order to perform bhakti. If we don't know what our nature is, and we don't know what the Lord's nature is, bhakti cannot be performed. So therefore, the Sambandhagyana is very important. Once we establish the Sambandhagyana, then we begin the activity of devotional service. However, there are many other activities which are recommended in the Vedas, particularly karma and jnana. These are called indirect processes. Karma is for people in the material world who have attachment to things here. In other words, they need their sense gratification with their material bodies. But karma allows them to get their sense of gratification with minimum of papa, or sinful activity. In other words, some restriction is put upon their sense gratification. And in this way, they can ensure for future lives that they can get maximum amount of material comforts. So the positive aspect of karma is there's some restriction on sense gratification and minimization of sinful activities. So that's good. The bad part is, of course, it is not ultimate because one stays in the material world. And ultimately it's not spiritual, not a spiritual process, because you stay in the material world. And the means you do that is doing punyas, and punyas, of course, are material. They give material results. So ultimately it's material. But compared to the rest of the people in the material world, karma is a good process because it at least restricts your sins. So one can lead an ethical, moral life and do punyas. So it's better than doing papa. In that sense, it's better. So this is what we call normally dharma. Common dharma is this. And varnashram system is part of this also. More advanced than that is jnana. Jnana arises from the realization that the material world actually is not beneficial for us. and therefore we try to get out of the material world. This is the realization of one who's practicing Jnana. And his process of Jnana means we meditate on this, that I don't belong to this material world. I am not part of this material world. It's a negation, a negative sadhana. I am not this material world. I am not part of this material world. I am spirit soul. Basically, it is rejection of the material world. So that we can say that is better than karma. It's a step upward because we have a realization we don't belong to the material world. And there's restriction on the senses there also. In fact, more restriction than in karma, because karma, you're still getting your sense gratification. Even if it's legal, for punyas, it's still sense gratification. So jnana attempts to reduce even that. Papa and punya are both considered bad for the jnani. So in that sense, it is more positive. It is rejection of all these material things and these illusions of sense gratification. The negative aspect of jnana is that not only do we negate the material world, but we also negate the Supreme Lord and His personality in the process. We don't want anything material, we don't want any persons, we don't want any names, we don't want any activities. So when we realize our spiritual nature, we also don't want activities and names and qualities. And so it becomes so negative that we also reduce the Ishvara to an impersonal entity. So that is the problem with jnana. So if we can say it's spiritual, because you get out of the material world through this process and you get mukti. But it is incomplete spiritual realization. This is its problem. It's incomplete. Moreover, when it becomes extreme, that is, we keep rejecting everything, it actually becomes offensive to the Supreme Lord and to bhakti. So it also therefore gets rejected as a real process for us, for those who are devotees. Its positive aspect is it rejects the material world of all sense gratification. So in that sense, it's also a step above materialism, gross materialism. But it is negative because it also rejects bhakti and the Supreme Lord. So the third process is bhakti or devotional service. This is superior to both because it is beyond the material world. We reject papa and punya, sinful activity and punyas to get material enjoyment. But we also reject the liberation. And we don't want to have a liberation where we have an impersonal realization of the Supreme Lord. So the goal of jnana is also rejected by the devotee. And in its place we have attaining eternal service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not exist for the karmis or the jnanis. That is for the devotees of the Lord. And the process to attain the Supreme Lord is the process of devotion. In jnana there is no devotion, and in karma there is no devotion. Karma will not recognize a Supreme Lord. Really, they recognize devatas to get their sense gratification. And if they do recognize Vishnu, they see him as only another devata. The jnanis don't recognize anybody as supreme. There's only Brahman who has no character at all, no qualities at all. So in devotional service, we recognize the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we worship that Supreme Person. And that worship is done with devotion, or bhakti, which in its mature state is called prema, or love. So when we say bhakti, that means, of course, also the same thing. Bhakti can be prema also, same thing. So bhakti is the sadhana, or the means, or abhidhaya, and the goal is prema, or bhakti also. And this takes place normally through what we call sadhana bhakti, that is called practice of devotional service, where we do some activities in an impure state in order to gradually progress to this pure state of prema. And it begins with faith, but faith begins from previous lifetimes of Agata Sukriti. Agata Sukriti means we do not have faith, so therefore we cannot do any activities of devotion. So we're in a hopeless position. So, though we don't do anything, accidentally we may contact devotional service in some way, or by the mercy of devotees, we get engaged in devotional service without knowing about it. That's called an Agata Sukriti. We do a devotional act without knowing that we're doing it, because we don't have any faith to do it. We're hopeless. So, due to the mercy of devotees, we get engaged. And that, of course, is what we do when we go out and give people prasadam and chant the holy name. This way they get engaged without knowing about it. They hear the holy name, fine. They may not react in this lifetime, but they heard it. And they didn't commit offense. So therefore, that is a gap of security for them. They take prasadam. That's a service to the Lord. And they don't know it's prasadam, but they get benefit from that. So such a gap of sukriti is valuable for a jiva who has no faith. If you preach to him without faith, then he won't listen to you. But if you trick him and somehow he's exposed to devotional service without his knowing it, then he gets great benefit from that. And by a lot of gap of sukriti, then eventually in some lifetimes he'll get shraddha of faith. And when he has faith, then with his own free will, his own consciousness and intelligence, he will begin to approach devotees and practice devotional service. That is the point at which he practices sadhana bhakti, and through that sadhana gradually he develops his sadhana sangha and anarjanavritti to nishta, ruchi, asakti, bhava, prema. So this is the general progress. So in the process of bhakti, we have among the processes chanting of the holy name of the Lord, our Nam Sankirtan. There's 9 processes, and among this is Sravanam and Kirtan, etc. Kirtan is one process. Kirtan, of course, can mean glorification of the Lord by chanting his name, or by describing his qualities, or his activities. It can be any of these things. However, another type of devotional service is particularly chanting the name of the Lord, the Nam Sankirtan, Nama. So this is mentioned among the 64 items of devotional service by Rupa Goswami. And of course it is even more famous because in Kali Yuga the process is Nam Sankirtan. This is the Yuga Dharma, which Lord Chaitanya taught. So in Kali Yuga particularly, the chanting of the name of the Lord is the potent process. And therefore, Lord Chaitanya came and taught that process, and Haridas Thakur was the acharya, or the great example of chanting the holy name. And in this way, Lord Chaitanya established the Yuga Dharma. Okay, any questions so far? Yes.
Maharaj, is the various elements of Abhidaya dependent on full understanding of Sama before one can escape?
Some understanding has to be there. In other words, if we are to perform devotional service, and I say, okay, devotional service means to worship Krishna. So then I say, okay, fine, I'll worship Krishna. And I begin. I say, how do I worship Krishna? So then I'll tell you how to worship Krishna. You can take some incense and light it and offer it to Krishna and different items. Like that. So then we call that devotional service. But actually, in a sense, that is devotional service. But we also know that the real definition of devotional service is that, or the basic, the main element there is, Anukulina Krishna Silanam, or activities, repeated activities for Krishna with a favorable attitude towards Krishna. But if we don't know who Krishna is, then we have a problem there. I'm directing my activities to Krishna, but I may think Krishna is a material person, or I may think he's a devata, or I may think ultimately he has no qualities at all, he's a Brahman. So I don't know exactly who that Krishna is, and I keep going in that direction, thinking Krishna is something which is wrong. Then I'll end up in the, I may end up merging into the Brahman instead of going to Krishna. And even if I think, yes, Krishna is a person, but I don't really know who he is, then still it's very difficult to render some devotion to him. If we say, okay, this is God, so now you must worship him and now you must love him. How are you going to love him? How are you going to offer your devotion to him when you don't even know who he is? So we have to know exactly who he is, what his form is, what his qualities are. And of course, if we do know the qualities and activities, then we can begin to admire and become attracted to him. Then we can say, oh yes, I will offer my devotion to this person. But if we have no idea, it's a very vague thing, then our devotion also will be very vague. Very, very vague thing if we don't know who he is. And of course, if we don't know who we are, again, then we have a problem, because as we see, many people think, yes, I am also a devotee of the Lord. I will worship the Lord and I will become the Lord. In which case, the devotion vanishes in the end. Their goal is, I will merge into the Lord. So they don't have a concept of the jiva as the eternal servant of the Lord. I will worship the Lord with such great devotion that I will become the Lord. So actually, that devotion is also not true. So in this way, we have to understand our position, the Lord's position, and do that. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult. This is discussed under Nama Bhas also again. Why? One of the reasons for Nama Bhas is no sambandh again. Now, that doesn't mean that chanting the holy name or doing any type of devotional service is absolutely worthless if we don't have knowledge also. It does have effect. But it is abhas. It is partial effect only, and the full potency is not there. And therefore, your progress is more slow. And if you do have proper knowledge, then your progress is much quicker. That's the difference.
Is this sambandha completely avideha, or do they go on simultaneously?
They would more or less go simultaneously, yeah. But we have to have some sort of sambandha to begin with. There's no knowledge at all, you cannot do anything. But faith means we do have, faith means we accept the Lord, at least we accept the Supreme Living Entity, a Supreme Lord. That's included in our faith. And without that faith, you're not going to do anything.
So then, how
does
the chanting, the
hearing,
become Abhideha instead of
Sambandha,
or is it actually over that?
Oh, I see, hearing. Oh, yeah, we can hear the Sambandha, then it becomes Abhideha in a sense. Yeah. Of course, ultimately, in Abhideha, the hearing is also the hearing about Krishna and his topic and his lila and things like that. That's, let's say, the higher stage of Abhideha. And lower, of course, so we just hear, and we hear the sambandha. So there's an overlapping in a sense also.
Just to know the nature of Vinod's body, when I'm doing such the nature, that is, if you just meditate on me on that part, and you said that's only jnana only. But actually, not that first you have to understand Vinod's body, and whatever happens, we just have to formulate and remember that actually nothing is happening very
much. Chapter 2,
Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita. Then, how do we actually correlate both, on one hand you have to understand when on this body is in the same place, the same time you shouldn't again keep on meditating later on the same one.
We should understand we're not the material body, we're spirit, so that is part of our sambandha again. But to realize that is automatically included in the process of devotion. It's not that through devotion we're first trying to say I'm not this material body and realize that first. That is automatic. The realization comes automatically when we establish our relationship with Krishna. When we practice devotional service, the jiva establishes a relationship with Krishna, spiritual entity. And the stronger that relationship becomes, the realization becomes automatically, and we'll realize we're not part of the material world. our attraction to the material world will get less and less as we develop our attraction for Krishna. So therefore that illusory bondage will decrease and decrease as the more we go in devotional service. So liberation is automatic for the process of devotional service. It's not an independent sadhana that we do along with bhakti. It is included in the process. So in Bilbo Mongol's prayer, he says that when we're worshipping Krishna, then bhakti and mukti both stand with folded hands waiting for some service. In other words, when you perform bhakti, then automatically you achieve the results. So the bhakti and mukti, karma and jnana, the results are both there for the devotee. So by achieving bhakti, we already surpass liberation and karma. How do we achieve bhakti? Well, see, bhakti comes in two parts. We achieve bhakti in the sense that prema is the ideal form of bhakti, it's love of Godhead. We achieve that by bhakti. We achieve bhakti by bhakti. It sounds strange. by doing sadhana bhakti, we attain pure bhakti or prema. So the means of attaining bhakti is through a process called sadhana bhakti. And through that sadhana we get to bhava bhakti and then prema bhakti. So what is that sadhana bhakti? The same activities we do in the sadhana bhakti are the same activities in prema bhakti. The only difference is our consciousness, that's all. So hearing, chanting, remembering are part of sadhana bhakti. They're also part of prema bhakti. Same activities. But one is in a pure state and one is in an impure state. So in Nectar of Devotion, there Rupa Goswami gives us 64 types of devotional service to do in sadhana bhakti. 64 different items there. We don't have to follow them, but many are important for us. There's 20 preliminary activities of bhakti mentioned, which you have to do before you do the hearing, chanting, remembering. There's 20 preliminary activities you have to follow also before that. They're called the door to bhakti. And after you do those 20, you observe the 20, then you can go on to the hearing, chanting, remembering, worshipping the deity, etc. Basically the 9 processes of devotional service. So those are the means by which we get to prema bhakti. And to start that, you need faith. Faith means you have a conviction that the Lord exists and that I should worship Him. I am a servant and I should worship Him. That faith has to be there to begin with. And then we can begin the process. If we don't have that faith, we cannot do the other processes. Other things. 64 others. And to get faith, that requires the mercy of Krishna and previous lifetimes of getting mercy of devotees. So basically, bhakti is caused by bhakti. Not by karma, not by jnana, not by punyas or anything. To get faith is only due to the gap of supratis, which means the mercy of devotees in previous lifetimes. And that mercy of devotees actually comes from Krishna. So ultimately bhakti is caused by Krishna's bhakti, not by anything in the material world. So no matter how many punyas you do in the material world, that does not guarantee you bhakti. If you become sattvic and you become a brahmana, that does not guarantee eventually you become devotional. The only thing that guarantees devotion is mercy of devotees for many lifetimes, by which we get faith, and then the faith, through that faith we associate with devotees, and we begin to practice. So the bhakti is caused by bhakti, and by, ultimately by the Supreme Lord.
You mentioned about
nitya-kriya.
Should we refer them for
jnana-kriya? What's that? Oh, what are yogis? Where do they fit in? Yeah. They are people, Bhaktivinoda describes them in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita as a further step from karma. When a person is involved in the material world, then he's attached to the results, and then he regulates himself, and that is called karma. And then, by doing yoga, he realizes in the material world, or in the Prakriti, he realizes the Supreme Lord is present. controlling everything, witnessing everything. So the realization of the Paramatma Yogi, he says, is simply an advancement from the karma, the person who's in karma, who is always looking at the material world and enjoying the material world. And when he sees the Supreme Lord in the material world, then that's Paramatma, then he's a yogi. So he says it's an advancement from karma. Now what is wrong with that? It's an incomplete realization of the Lord, just as Jnana also is an incomplete realization of the Lord. They are not wrong in one sense, because the Lord is absolute, but they're all partial. And if it's partial, then the jiva cannot be satisfied with a partial realization. And just like the happiness in the material world also is not suitable to the jiva, because it is not complete. It is temporary. An example can be given like this. If we look at a mountain from 50 miles away, then we'll see that there is a shape on the horizon and it's blue. And we say, that's a mountain. If we go maybe 5 miles away from the mountain, then we'll see the mountain is not blue actually, it's actually green, and it's got some trees on it and some rocks on it. So that does not mean that the first perception is completely wrong, but it is more general. And when we get a little closer, then we have more details or more knowledge of the mountain, because you can see it close up. If we go directly to the mountain, and we climb up the mountain, then we'll see that the mountain actually has animals on it and various other things there, maybe some waterfalls and streams and other things, and we can actually look at the rocks and see what type of rocks they are. All this, we have many, many details. So all three are realizations of what the mountain is, but from different perspectives, so to speak. And the one close up is more complete than the one from far away. So similarly, through bhakti, we get a close-up vision of the Lord. Not just a vision, a participation with the Lord in His activities. But from Brahman, it's at a very great distance, in which you have a general idea that what spirit is, that is, it's eternal. And it's not part of the material world. That is our realization. Spirit is very nice. It's eternal. It's beyond birth and death, old age and disease. It is pure consciousness. When we realize Paramatma, we realize there is a personality of the Lord who pervades this whole material creation. But we don't think, oh, the Supreme Lord has a spiritual world where we can relate with Him. No, that realization is not there. There's a personality who is pervading this material world. He is the creator of the material world, the destroyer of the material world, the maintainer of the material world. That much you realize. But we don't establish a relationship with that Lord, and therefore we don't do any service to that Lord. So it is in Shanta Rasa, actually. It's a Shanta relation with the Lord, neutral relationship with the Lord. So it's partial. Okay. We can say it's better than Brahman, because we do recognize a person, but it is not complete, because it's only up to Shanta Rasa. There's no devotional activities involved with the Lord. Yeah, in one sense, yeah. The problem with the yogis, however, is usually they're influenced by impersonalism also. And even if they do realize Paramatma, and they have bad association of Maya bodies, then they will want to merge into the Paramatma, or into the effulgence of Paramatma. So then their goal is the same as the Maya bodies. It's not necessarily the case. If they get good association, then they can advance from that and become devotees also. It's possible. But then again, even Maya bodies are impersonalists. If they get associated with devotees, they can also become Vaishnavas. That is the case of the Kumaras. They were Brahmavadis, they were impersonalists to begin with. But by the mercy of the Lord, they got some devotional service by smelling the tulsi mixed with the sandalwood called from the Lord's feet. And when they smelled that, then they started getting ecstatic symptoms and they became devotees of the Lord. So it is possible for impersonalists or yogis to become devotees. But if we don't get the mercy of the Lord or the devotee, then they can all merge into the Lord and stay that way.
Do some souls stay eternally?
Well, the Bhagavatam says that after great difficulty, one attains that level of Brahman, but then after attaining that with great difficulty, then eventually they fall back into the material world again. So it's not permanent. It's a long time from our observation, our perception. May look like a long time, they say that, but eventually they come back again to the material world. Why? Because the jiva by nature wants to be active. He wants to do something. And that state of suppression of all individuality, no activity, etc., is not as satisfying to the jiva. So therefore, he falls out of that state, comes back to the material world to do some activity again.
The Buddha journey
has
a different destination than Mahabharata.
Who?
The Buddha journey.
Prabhupada once mentioned that the Buddhists go to the Viraja, the edge. It's kind of like a borderline region. And in other words, less even than the Gyanis. I personally have not seen anywhere else where it's discussed so much. In a sense, the Buddhists are, because they reject, we kind of reject them and don't discuss them at all. We call them Naptikas or atheists. So we put them even in a lower category. But technically, it is very similar to Mayavad philosophy. And therefore we call Mayavad philosophy covered Buddhism. The concept of sunya ultimately becomes very similar to the impersonal Brahman. Because like the impersonal Brahman, the sunya has no name, form, qualities, activities, or anything. And they call it nothing. But in Shankara's philosophy, we have a supreme absolute substance, a thing, not a nothing. But then, it has no name, form, qualities, anything, so it becomes a nothing also. Ultimately, it becomes nothing also. So that's why we call it covered Buddhism. It is Buddhism, but we call it Brahman. And we give it some Vedic authority. But practically speaking, we're speaking of the same thing as sunya, actually. So called covered Buddhism. So that we can say a similar goal, at least. Huh? Then again, of course, it would depend on the particular attainment of a particular person. And in Buddhism itself, again, there's a problem because we have different concepts of what that sunya is. And some say actually doesn't mean nothing at all. There's something else there. So there's controversy there. And then some people say that ultimately you go to the pure land of Buddha. That is the liberation. And it's like Vaikuntha, or Svargaloka, or something like that. You know, it's a spiritual world. So there's varying concepts of what that goal is in Buddhism among different sects.
Maybe you said that
we're going to
the Viraja.
Viraja. Now, Viraja. And that is actually where Mahavishnu lies. And the Karana ocean is also called the Viraja. Viraja means that it is the borderline between the material and the spiritual worlds. The Achit world and the Chit world. In other words, between Vaikuntha and the material world, there's somewhere they got to meet. So that meeting point is a neutral zone, so to speak. And that's called the Viraja. Virajanadi. It's actually more than a river, I suppose. It's like three-dimensional. If we have the material world, the universe is all kind of like a big glob. And then around that glob, we've got an insulation. And then beyond that, we've got a spiritual world. So that insulation area is called the Viraja, or the Karana ocean. And that's where Mahavishnu resides. He's between the material and spiritual worlds.
Is there any difference between the Mayavadis and the Brahmavadis?
What is the difference? Mayavad refers to a follower of Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya says the material world is not real, nor are the jivas real. They have no existence. Only Brahman has existence. So therefore, if we
look at this material world is actually illusory or maya. And the jiva also is maya. It doesn't really exist. It's actually Brahman. But he thinks he's individual, but he's not. That's called Mayavad. Proponents of the theory of maya, or everything is illusion except Brahman. So that's a particular theory of Shankaracharya. Other impersonalists don't necessarily say that, that everything is illusion. But they will say that ultimately what we call the Ishvara, or the Supreme God, has no form and qualities. And then he's an impersonalist. But he doesn't have to say that the jiva is illusion or the material world is illusion. He doesn't have to say that. But he still says that Ishvara is impersonal. So he's called a Brahmavadi, or impersonalist. So my bodies are particularly the followers of Shankaracharya, who say that the material world is false, Sangha Nitya.
Brahmavadi says that Ishvara is the
Supreme Lord is impersonal.
Yeah.
But doesn't have to say the material world is illusory. Like the Sankhya philosophers and the Nyaya philosophers following Gautama, they're all impersonalists. Not Mayavadis though, because they came before Shankaracharya actually, and his philosophy. But they're all impersonalists ultimately. Yes, we accept the Ishvara, the Supreme Lord is there. But we don't do any devotion to him. We don't know who he is or what he is. Okay, I'll cover a little bit more on that. So, out of all this, finally we get the path of bhakti, and in the path of bhakti, to get prema and go to the Supreme Lord's abode, we have the process of bhakti. In the process of bhakti, we have the name. So, as I said, the Supreme Lord is the supreme entity, but he also has energies. And through these energies, he manifests different things. So his chit shakti manifests his name, his qualities, his form, his activities, and his rasas. This is the energies of the Lord. So in other words, the personality of the Lord arises through his chit shakti. And in the spiritual world, unlike in the material world, the name, the form, and the qualities and activities of the Lord cannot be separated from him. One is equal to the other. They're all absolute. Just like the parts of the body, though the hand is the hand and the foot is the foot, they can do each other's functions. Or the eye can do the function of the foot, or the tongue can do the function of the eye, and eye can do the function of the tongue, and ear can do the function of the eye. They're all interchangeable in one sense. So, therefore, through the activities or the qualities or the name, we can also approach the Lord, because they're not different from him. And among these, the name is the main process of approaching the Lord. Through the chanting of the name, we can realize not only the name, but the form, and the qualities, and the activities, and the rasa of the Lord. We can get complete realization of the Lord fully through chanting his name. And in Kali Yuga, this is considered to be the main process for us to follow in order to realize the Lord chanting the holy name. In other yugas, like they use different processes, like some meditation, etc., to attain the Lord. In Kali Yuga, the name is the most effective process. So there are different types of names of the Lord, different types of nama. There are Gona Nama. Gona, of course, means secondary. Gona can also mean come from Guna. Guna becomes Gona. Guna means, of course, related to the gunas. Agona would mean related to the gunas, and that means related to the material world. So when we relate the Lord to the material world, then we get gonanam, or secondary names. That is, Supreme Creator, or Ishvara, or Paramatma. Paramatma is in relation to the material world, the witness of everything. Shakti. These are all those names which describe the Lord in relation to the material world and his functions in relation to the material world. These are called secondary names. Primary names describe the Lord in his transcendental pastimes, simply for enjoyment in his lila, not with regard to the material world and its functions here at all. Such as Shamsundar, or Madana Mohan, or Gopal, or Govinda. These are considered primary names of the Lord. So when we speak about chanting the name of the Lord, we mean the primary names, not the secondary names. If you chant the secondary names, then you'll get Paramatma realization. So we chant the primary names of the Lord. And these will give realization of form, quality, activities, and thus of the Lord. But if you chant the secondary names, you will not get that realization. So we chant the primary names of the Lord, and because the Lord has infinite number of qualities and activities in the spiritual world, the Lord will have infinite number of names, also primary names. But the name of Krishna is special. It is said in the Puranas that the three names of Rama is equal to one name of Krishna. Of course, all Rama is also the name of the Lord, so there's no problem there. But Krishna is very special. The name of Krishna is very special because it includes within it all of the other names. It includes all the qualities and pastimes of the Lord. Of course, it means all attractive. So Krishna is all attractive with his qualities and his form and his activities. So the name Krishna is special, even though there's so many names of the Lord. And there are different types of chanting of the names of the Lord. The primary names, let's see the primary names. There's, and particularly now we're talking about Krishna's name. For us, we talk about Krishna's name. And Krishna's name, we're talking about the Hare Krishna mantra, actually. So in the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, the name of the Lord, there are three basic categories. One is called Nam Aparad, chanting with offense. When we chant Nam Aparad, actually, we have a conception that Krishna and his name are different. In other words, Krishna and his name are both material things. And we have hostility towards the Lord, or towards the devotees, or towards the process of bhakti. That's basically what Namaparad is, right? Intentional hostility towards the Lord and his devotees and the process of bhakti. And what is the effect of that? No progress. No devotional service results from that. Rather the opposite. It's very dangerous. And if you have devotional service, it can destroy your devotional service. So it has no beneficial effects at all, either from the point of karma or from the point of view of bhakti. Karma-wise, you simply get bad results there. You suffer in the material world, like a papa. And devotionally, it'll destroy any bhakti that you have. And it'll guarantee you won't get bhakti for a long time if you don't have any to begin with. So very bad. That's Nama Parat. The second type is called Nama Bhapa. That's chanting the holy name, but we have ignorance or impurities. That'll be discussed later. Ignorance, of course, means ignorance of, among other things, the Supreme Lord, the Jiva, and what is matter, all these things, the Sambhamagyan. We're ignorant of that. And impurities, various material desires. So we chant the holy name willingly or unwillingly. Not unwillingly, but maybe accidentally. Both are considered namavas. For instance, if one is a devotee and one is ignorant of sambandhagyan and one is chanting, that is called namavas. Or if we have some knowledge, but we have many desires also to fulfill the devotional service, the mixed devotional service, that is called namavas. And there's another type of namavas that is for the non-believers. That's accidental chanting, such as Ajamil. He chanted the name in rhyme because it was the name of his son. So he didn't intentionally become devotional when he was dying. He was calling out for his son. But he called out the name of Vishnu. So that's namavas. And he gets effect from that. So that's accidental chanting. He's chanting in ignorance, and it's also accidental. So the namavas is chanted with ignorance and impurities, etc. Huh? What is the effect? Slow progress. Some progress is there, but it is slow. And what it does do, it leads to purification. It leads to reduction of karmas, cancellation of karmas, cancellation of sinful desires. This is what it does. In itself, it does not give Krishna prema. But it can lead eventually to chanting purely, or sudhanam. And if you do sudhanam, chant sudhanam, then through that you get Krishna prema. So it's an indirect process of chanting. So it has some effect, but not full effect. And it's only partial. It goes up to sudhanam, or pure chanting. Then pure chanting, we go on, then we get Krishna. So the third category is sudhanam, or pure chanting. That means we chant the holy name with proper knowledge, no ignorance, and with no impurities, with purity of desire. In other words, we're not chanting for our own self, not for liberation, not for material benefits, not for fame, only to please Krishna. We chant only to please Krishna, understanding who Krishna is, and that we are his servant, and it's called sudhanam, pure chanting. So if we chant like that, then you get, from this stage, you can go to Krishna Prema. And you can get there quickly. Now, in this sudhanam, there are three types. This is described by Lord Chaitanya in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the, when Lord Chaitanya was in Puri, then the people from Bengal would come every year to visit him. Just before Rath Yatra, and they stay for the Rath Yatra the day after, and then they would go back to Bengal after that. So the people of Kulingram or Navadvipa, they came one year, and they asked Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava? And then Lord Chaitanya said, anyone who chants the name of the Lord once is a Vaishnava. So the devotees didn't want to say anything. They were a little puzzled by that statement, but they kept their mouths shut, and they went back to Bengal. And then all year they thought about that answer. What does this mean? Anyone who chants once is a Vaishnava. And the next year they went back to Puri again, and then they asked Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava again? Then Lord Chaitanya says, one who chants the holy name of Krishna constantly is a Vaishnava. So he gave a different answer. Then again, they didn't say anything, and they went back to Bengal, and they thought about that for another year. Then they went back the next year, and they said to Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava? And then Lord Chaitanya said, he is a Vaishnava whom, upon seeing, makes you chant the holy name. So, he gave three definitions of a Vaishnava who chants the holy name. A one who chants once, one who chants constantly, and one who makes others chant the holy name. Most of the people explain that when he says one who chants once is a Vaishnava, he says once purely. But at least one should chant, but then to chant purely, you have to have knowledge. And you have to understand that you shouldn't have material desires, and at least at once when you chant, you chant without desires. Yeah? So, one who chants purely once, he is a Vaishnava. That's the lowest category. And one who can continually chant on this level with no desires, only for Krishna, with proper understanding who is Krishna, then he is better Vaishnava. And one who is chanting like this, purely, constantly, who can influence others to chant purely, then he's the best Vaishnava. So, he's an advancement on the second category, that is one who chants purely, constantly. He also does that, but he has become purified to such an extent that people who meet him, they also get affected by that, and they also begin to chant purely. So that is the first class Vaishnava, was chanting purely. And of course, you see that is also the one who is the preacher, one who has the potency to inspire others to chant purely. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's only two elements in Lord Chaitanya's movement. One is Name Ruchi, and the other is Jive Doya. Name Ruchi is to develop a taste for chanting the holy name. Understanding there is, of course, is pure chanting. So we develop a taste for chanting Krishna's name, and through the chanting we develop a taste for Krishna, for serving Krishna. That is one aspect. The other aspect is Jive Doya, to give out mercy to the fallen souls. And that mercy consists of giving them the holy name. So these two aspects are personified in the highest categories. One who is fixed up in the holy name, and people who meet him also begin to chant the holy name. He is the preacher. So he has fixed up himself, and then he inspires others to also begin chanting the holy name purely. He is considered the Vaishnava. So what is the qualification for beginning to chant the holy name? One qualification is any human being. He has a qualification. If we're a human being, we don't have to be in any specific varna or ashrama, a brahmachari or a sannyasi or a grihastha or a vanaprastha can chant, and a sudra can chant, a malecha can chant, a brahmana can chant, anyone can chant the holy name, as long as we're a human being. But to seriously chant, that is, we have to have faith. That is considered better than having no faith. In other words, Ajamil had no faith, or the Muslim who chants haram when he gets killed by the boar in the forest, he also has no faith. So that is considered a type of chanting for the hopeless people. That's namabas, because it chants the name of the Lord, but it's accidental. So the more effective level comes when we have faith and we chant. Now when we have faith and chant, of course it can be namabas also. We can still have ignorance and we still have desires, so it can be namabas. But nevertheless, when we develop faith, that is considered a big step forward. So though all human beings are qualified to chant, those who have faith and chant the holy name, those are considered devotees of the Lord. So we usually consider faith as to be the qualification for practicing bhakti and for chanting the holy name seriously. That means we have that conviction in the Lord. So, in chanting the holy name, because the holy name is so powerful, it does not require the same qualifications as other processes. In other words, there's no restriction on place and time and cleanliness and other things. Whereas with karma and jnana, there's always restrictions. Certain times are not pure, certain places are not pure, certain people are not pure, like this, and certain conditions are not pure. So you cannot do karmas at certain times, or you cannot practice or meditation again at certain times, and certain places and certain conditions. Bhakti can be practiced all times and places, and the name, particularly, is so powerful that there are no considerations. Any time, any place, anybody, anywhere, any condition, you chant the holy name, and there's no problems. It will always be effective. So what, in summary, what are we supposed to do? We should chant the holy name, the primary name of Krishna, particularly the name of Krishna, and we should chant it constantly, and we should chant it purely, that is, without ignorance, with knowledge, samadhyam, and with pure intentions, that is, with pleasing Krishna only, not for our own sense gratification, in the association of Vaishnavas, and avoiding unfavorable actions, which will decrease bhakti or create obstacles. And in this way, we will get to Krishna Prema, the goal. So that basically covers two chapters. Any questions? How do we progress from what? Well, that's not a real progression from Nama Parad to Nama Bhav.
How do you get free of this Nama Parad?
Yeah, well, that was discussed in the main part of the book, actually. We can be at the stage of Nama Bhav, and then we can commit Nama Parad. Nama Parad, of course, is sometimes included within Nama Bhav when it's not serious. In other words, we're devotees of the Lord, and generally we're not committing, you know, we're favorable to the Lord already and to the process of bhakti, and we understand the Lord is supreme and is not equal to David, that's all they think we understand, like that. But it may be that we do sometimes commit inadvertently or some carelessness, we may commit some aparad. So that is not so serious. So that's all considered under Nama Bhav, actually, those Nama Parad. But when there is hostility, direct hostility to the Lord or the devotees, then that becomes Nama Parad. Huh? So when the, let's say the Nama Bhav, Nama Parad become more and more frequent, and then we develop a bad intention, and then it becomes real Nama Parad. Then that will begin to destroy bhakti. And we won't have any Nama Bhakti at that stage. That can also disappear. And we'll be left with nothing.
How can you get the Nama Bhakti?
Oh, yeah, so Nama Bhav, then that's discussed next. What is Nama Bhav and how to overcome it? That's discussed next.
Constantly chant?
Well, in Vaidhi Bhakti, there, Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion says that there are many rules and regulations, but ultimately, the goal of all the rules and regulations is always remember Krishna and never forget him. So we do devotional service, all sorts of activities of devotional service, more and more, so that we'll always be remembering Krishna and never forgetting him. So one of the main ways of doing that is by constantly chanting Krishna's name. And we always remember him and never forget him. And the ideal example of that is Haridas Thakur, who was chanting all day and all night. And that's why he avoided the prostitutes. Because I have to finish my rounds. And he chanted all night until the sun rose. And I said, sorry, I haven't finished my rounds. So this way, Maya could not grab him. So that, of course, is the high stage, because he chanted, you know, so many rounds. But as much as possible, we have to, you know, take shelter of the holy name at all times. And the more we do that, the better effect we get.
If you're chanting holy name, you're not chanting
to hear
him. If you're chanting
holy name,
you're chanting.
Oh. Oh. Well, that's called inattentive chanting. And that becomes one of the aparads. Bhaktivinoda includes that as one of the 10 aparads, actually, here. So when he says chant purely, it also means attentively.
Where
the
development of faith in the name,
from the association with the name? Faith. Well, the beginning faith is through Gyatasukritis.
Yeah.
That's faith in bhakti itself, faith in the Lord, and then faith in the process of bhakti. And through that we begin chanting through Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Sangha is important all along, you see. And we begin chanting through that. And through that Sadhu Sangha, then we can give up Nama Bhas and go to purity.
So, what about the
development of faith and carrying on to sit in the arm?
Is this through
the if we have faith in the beginning and then we do Bhajana Kriya, we chant the holy name, and then that faith develops and develops into strong conviction in the Lord, and then it transforms into bhakti, and into bhava, and then into prema as we go on. In the beginning, faith actually is faith in the scriptures. We accept the version of scriptures. And then what the scripture says we do, that is called vaidhi bhakti. Our faith is in the statement of the authority of scripture. And this is, scripture says do this, we do it like that. Huh? But as we go on, of course, then we do develop an attraction for the Lord himself inherent. And we want to do activities favorably to the Lord for his pleasure. And as that increases, and that turns into bhava and prema. Of course, the Ruchi is actually prema.
When you say Namaparas, it actually describes the devotional service.
Yes.
But it says in devotional service is never described.
Yeah. That's a general principle, to encourage everybody to do devotional service, and even if they die, they can still continue in the next lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
The exception is Namaparas. If you do that, then you can destroy it. So generally, it's not destroyed. It is not destroyed by sinful activity. It's not destroyed by your death. So Krishna also says, even if you're the most sinful person, you're still my devotee. So even if you do commit sinful activity, that is not destroyed. But if it becomes aparad, that will destroy. So regular papa does not destroy. Of course, the papa becomes constant, and then you commit the seventh aparad, commit sinful activities from the strength of the line, then that will destroy bhakti. But if it's the accidental sin, where you do some sinful activity, okay, you fall down or whatever, Krishna does not take that so badly. And the next lifetime, you can continue with whatever faith you had and whatever bhakti you had, you can continue the next lifetime.
Is it easy to commit sinful activity, or is it
for the devotee, generally, sinful activity would be more common than aparad. The aparad would be, let's say, more unintentional than intentional. Because when we get faith, then we have, by our own free will, chosen to worship the Lord. So generally, we're not going to back down and then start becoming hostile to the Lord or the devotees intentionally. But because we do have material desires, then we are liable to commit sinful activities. So that's probably more common than real serious aparadas. However, if we are inattentive in devotional service, we do have ignorance, then the aparadas can be there. They can become common also. If we're inattentive and we're in ignorance, if we don't know what to do in devotional service, then we can commit aparadas. But they're more or less unintentional or through ignorance rather than through intention. But through bad associations with materialists or atheists or Mayavadis or non-Vaishnavas of any sort, one can become imposed to commit aparadas. And then one will lose a taste for devotional service and chanting, and then one will develop a taste for material things and commit sinful activities. So aparadas could lead to the commission of sinful activities also. Any more questions?
Initially you mentioned that when you're at the level of karma, because the law of karma is there, it prevents us from doing a lot more wrong. And then you said that when you're at the level of there is more positive, there is a higher level, but there is a greater negative to it. But then when you talk about when you're in the devotional service, the progress is much faster. But if when you go to Dhamma, it can go back quite slowly. How do you guard that message?
How do we guard against Dhamma Prat? We have to acknowledge so that we don't commit operands.
Huh?
Unintentional? Of course, unintentional, that's material world, so we can't really prevent that. Maybe if it's accidental, we don't even know about it. So that's not so serious as the when we say namapara, basically we're speaking of the intentional one, ultimately. That's the one that destroys bhakti. The other one may cause a problem, but it's not going to destroy bhakti. It may slow it down a little bit until we rectify it. But the serious one is the intentional aparad.
I'm
going to
say it's knowledge.
Mm.
Yeah, you don't have knowledge. You just have
to do
a little bit of knowledge.
Well, as much as to practice bhakti correctly without committing aparad, that much we have to have. Of course, the more knowledge we have of Krishna, the better for us, because the more attractive we can become to Krishna, and that will help us in our devotion. So that is why Bhagavad Gita says one should listen very carefully to the Srimad Bhagavatam and enjoy the pastimes of Krishna, and relish the pastimes of Krishna. And then we become more attracted to Krishna, and then we can serve Krishna better by that attraction. Okay. Hare Krishna.